Good evening. Welcome to the Bookshelf. This is Mike Ailman. We'll continue tonight with Count Leo Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Ilyich. Each day after he would return home, Ivan Ilyich would find that his wife and daughter had been out paying calls or had a visitor, that his son had been to the gymnasium, had gone over his lessons with a tutor, and was diligently learning all that students are taught in the gymnasium. Everything was just fine. After dinner, if there were no guests, Ivan Ilyich sometimes read a book that was the talk of the day, and in the evening settled down to work. That is, read official papers, checked laws, compared depositions, and classified them according to the legal statutes. He found such work neither boring nor engaging. It was a bore if it meant foregoing a card game, but if there was no game on, it was better than sitting home alone or with his wife. Ivan Ilyich derived pleasure from giving small dinner parties to which he invited men and women of good social standing, and the dinners he gave resembled the ones they usually gave, as much as his drawing room looked like all the other drawing room. Once they even had an evening party with dancing. Ivan Ilyich was in fine spirits and everything went off well, except that he had an enormous fight with his wife over the pastries and bonbons. Praskovya Fyodorovna had her own plans about these, but Ivan Ilyich insisted on ordering everything from an expensive confectioner. He ordered a great many pastries, and the quarrel broke out because some of the pastries were left over, and the bill came to 45 rubles. It was such an enormous nasty fight that Praskovya Fyodorovna called him imbecile and a spoiler, while he clutched his head and inwardly muttered something about a divorce. But the party itself was gay. The best people came, and Ivan Ilyich danced with Princess Trufanova, sister of the Trufanova who had founded the charitable society called Take My Grief Upon Thee. The pleasures Ivan Ilyich derived from his work were those of pride, the pleasures he derived from society those of vanity. But it was genuine pleasure that he derived from playing whist. He confessed that no matter what happened, regardless of all the unhappiness he might experience, there was one pleasure which, like a bright candle, outshone all the others in his life, and that was to sit down with some good players, quiet partners, to a game of whist. Definitely a four-handed game. With five players, it was painful to sit out, even though one pretended not to mind. To play a clever, serious game, when the cards permitted, then have supper and drink a glass of wine. After a game of whist, especially if he had won a little, winning a lot was distasteful, Ivan Ilyich went to bed in a particularly good mood. So they lived. They moved in the best circles, and their home was frequented by people of importance and by the young. There was complete accord between husband, wife, and daughter about their set of acquaintances, and without discussing the matter, they were equally adept at brushing off and escaping from various shabby friends and relations who, in a show of affection, descended on them in their drawing room with the Japanese plates on the walls. Soon these shabby friends stopped intruding, and the Golovin set included only the best. Young men courted Lizanka, and the examining magistrate Petrushchev, the son and sole heir of Dmitry Ivanovich Petrushchev, was so attentive that Ivan Ilyich talked to Praskovya Fyodorovna about having a sleighing party for them or arranging some private theatricals. So they lived. Everything went along without change, and everything was fine. Chapter 4. They were all in good health. Ivan Ilyich sometimes complained of a strange taste in his mouth and some discomfort on his left side, but this could hardly be called ill health. Yet the discomfort increased, and although it had not developed into real pain, the sense of a constant pressure in his side made Ivan Ilyich ill-tempered. His irritability became progressively more marked and began to spoil the pleasure of the easy and proper life that had only recently been established in the Golovin family. Husband and wife began to quarrel more often, and soon the ease and pleasure disappeared, and even the propriety was barely maintained. Scenes became more frequent. Once again, they were only little islands, very few at that, on which husband and wife could meet without an explosion. Praskovya Fyodorovna had good reason now for saying that her husband had a trying disposition. With her characteristic tendency to exaggerate, she said he had always had such a horrid disposition, and that only someone with her goodness of heart could have put up with it for 20 years. It was true that he was the one now who started the arguments. He invariably began caviling when he sat down to dinner, often just as he was starting on his soup. Either he noticed that a dish was chipped, or the food was not good, or his son had put his elbow on the table, or his daughter had not combed her hair properly. And for all this, he blamed Praskovya Fyodorovna. At first she fought back and said nasty things to him, but once or twice at the start of dinner, he flew into such a rage that she realized it was due to some physical discomfort provoked by eating, and so she restrained herself and did not answer back, but merely tried to get dinner over with as quickly as possible. Praskovya Fyodorovna regarded her self-restraint as a great virtue. Having concluded that her husband had a horrid disposition and had made her life miserable, she began to pity herself. And the more she pitied herself, the more she hated her husband. She began to wish he would die. Yet she could not really wish that, for then there would be no income. This made her even more incensed with him. She considered herself supremely unhappy because even his death could not save her. She was exasperated, yet concealed it, and her suppressed exasperation only heightened his exasperation. After a scene in which Ivan Ilyich had been particularly unjust and, by way of explanation, admitted being irritable but attributed this to illness, she told him that if he was ill, he must be treated, and she insisted he go and consult a celebrated physician. He did. The whole procedure was just what he expected, just what one always encounters. There was the waiting, the doctor's exaggerated air of importance, so familiar to him since it was the very air he assumed in court, the tapping, the listening, the questions requiring answers that were clearly superfluous since they were foregone conclusions, and the significant look that implied, "Just put yourself in our hands, and we'll take care of everything. We know exactly what has to be done. We always use one and the same method for every patient, no matter who." Everything was just as it was in court. The celebrated doctor dealt with him in precisely the manner he dealt with men on trial. The doctor said, "Such and such indicates that you have such and such. But if an analysis of such and such does not confirm this, then we have to assume that you have such and such. On the other hand, if we assume such and such is the case, then..." And so on. To Ivan Ilyich, only one question mattered. Was his condition serious or not? But the doctor ignored this inappropriate question. From his point of view, it was an idle question and not worth considering. One simply had to weigh the alternatives: a floating kidney, chronic catarrh, or a disease of the cecum. It was not a matter of Ivan Ilyich's life, but a conflict between a floating kidney and a disease of the cecum. And in Ivan Ilyich's presence, the doctor resolved that conflict brilliantly in favor of the cecum, with the reservation that if an analysis of the urine yielded new evidence, the case would be reconsidered. This was exactly what Ivan Ilyich had done 1,000 times, and in the same brilliant manner, with prisoners in the dock. The doctor summed up just as brilliantly, glancing triumphantly, even jovially, over his glasses at the prisoner. From the doctor's summary, Ivan Ilyich concluded that things were bad, but that to the doctor, and perhaps everyone else, it was of no consequence, even though for him it was bad. And this conclusion, which came as a painful shock to Ivan Ilyich, aroused in him a feeling of great self-pity and equally great resentment toward the doctor for being so indifferent to a matter of such importance. But he made no comment. He simply got up, put his fee on the table, heaved a sigh, and said, "No doubt, we sick people often ask inappropriate questions. But in general, would you say my illness is serious or not?" The doctor cocked one eye sternly at him over his glasses, as if to say, "Prisoner, if you do not confine yourself to the questions allowed, I shall be obliged to have you expelled from the courtroom." "I have already told you what I consider necessary and suitable," said the doctor. "Anything further will be revealed by the analysis." And with a bow, the doctor brought the visit to a close. Ivan Ilyich went out slowly, seated himself despondently in his sledge, and drove home. All the way home, he kept going over in his mind what the doctor had said, trying to translate all those vague, confusing scientific terms into simple language and find an answer to his question. Is my condition serious, very serious, or nothing much to worry about? And it seemed to him that the essence of what the doctor had said was that it was very serious. Everything in the streets seemed dismal to Ivan Ilyich. The cab drivers looked dismal. The houses looked dismal. The passers-by, the shops, everything looked dismal. And in light of the doctor's obscure remarks, that pain, that dull, nagging pain which never let up for a second, acquired a different, a more serious implication. Ivan Ilyich focused on it now with a new sense of distress. He reached home and began telling his wife about the visit. She listened, but in the middle of his account, his daughter came in with her hat on. She and her mother were preparing to go out. She forced herself to sit and listen to this tedious stuff, but could not stand it for long, and his wife, too, did not hear him out. "Well, I'm very glad," she said. "Now see to it that you take your medicine regularly. Give me the prescription. I'll send Gerasim to the apothecaries." And she went off to dress. While she was in the room, Ivan Ilyich had scarcely paused for breath, but he heaved a deep sigh when she left. "Well," he said, "maybe there's nothing much to worry about." He began to take the medicine and follow the doctor's instructions, which were changed after the analysis of his urine. But then it appeared that there was some confusion about the results of the analysis and what should have followed from it. It was impossible to get any information out of the doctor, but somehow things were not working out as he had said they should. Either the doctor had overlooked something, or lied, or concealed something from him. Nonetheless, Ivan Ilyich followed his instructions explicitly and at first derived some comfort from this. After his visit to the doctor, Ivan Ilyich was preoccupied mainly with attempts to carry out the doctor's orders about hygiene, medicine, observation of the course of his pain, and all his bodily functions. His main interests in life became human ailments and human health. Whenever there was any talk in his presence of people who were sick or who had died or recuperated, particularly from an illness resembling his own, he would listen intently, trying to conceal his agitation, ask questions, and apply what he learned to his own case. The pain did not subside, but Ivan Ilyich forced himself to think he was getting better. And he managed to deceive himself as long as nothing upset him. But no sooner did he have a nasty episode with his wife and set back at work or a bad hand at cards than he immediately became acutely aware of his illness. In the past, he had been able to cope with such adversities, confident that in no time at all he would set things right, get the upper hand, succeed, have a grand slam. Now every setback knocked the ground out from under him and reduced him to despair. He would say to himself, "There, just as I was beginning to get better and the medicine was taking effect, this accursed misfortune or trouble had to happen." And he raged against misfortune or against the people who were causing him trouble and killing him, for he felt his rage was killing him but could do nothing to control it. One would have expected him to understand that the anger he vented on people and circumstances only aggravated his illness, and that, consequently, the thing to do was to disregard unpleasant occurrences. But his reasoning took just the opposite turn. He said he needed peace. He was on the lookout for anything that might disturb it, and at the slightest disturbance became exasperated. What made matters worse was that he read medical books and consulted doctors. His condition deteriorated so gradually that he could easily deceive himself when comparing one day with the next. The difference was that slight. But when he consulted doctors, he felt he was not only deteriorating, but at a very rapid rate. And in spite of this, he kept on consulting them. That month, he went to see another celebrated physician. This celebrity told him practically the same thing as the first, but posed the problem somewhat differently. And the consultation with this celebrity only reinforced Ivan Ilyich's doubts and fears. A friend of a friend, a very fine doctor, diagnosed the case quite differently. And though he assured Ivan Ilyich that he would recover, his questions and suppositions only made him more confused and heightened his suspicions. A homeopath offered still another diagnosis and prescribed certain medicine. And for about a week, Ivan Ilyich took it without telling anyone. But when a week passed with no sign of relief, he lost faith in both this and the previous types of treatment and became even more despondent. Once a lady he knew told him about a cure effected with wonder-working icons. Ivan Ilyich caught himself listening intently and believing in the possibility. This incident alarmed him. "Have I really become so gullible?" he asked himself. "Nonsense, it's all rubbish. Instead of giving in to these nervous fears, I've got to choose one doctor and stick to his method and treatment. That's just what I'll do. Enough. I'll stop thinking about it and follow the doctor's orders strictly until summer and then see what happens. No more wavering." It was an easy thing to say, but impossible to do. The pain in his side exhausted him, never let up, seemed to get worse all the time. The taste in his mouth became more and more peculiar. He felt his breath had a foul odor. His appetite diminished, and he kept losing strength. There was no deceiving himself. Something new and dreadful was happening to him, something of such vast importance that nothing in his life could compare with it. And he alone was aware of this. Those about him either did not understand or did not wish to understand and thought that nothing in the world had changed. It was precisely this which tormented Ivan Ilyich most of all. He saw that the people in his household, particularly his wife and daughter, who were caught up in a whirl of social activity, had no understanding of what was happening and were vexed with him for being so disconsolate and demanding, as though he were to blame. Although they tried to conceal this, he saw that he was an obstacle to them, and that his wife had adopted a certain attitude toward his illness and clung to it regardless of what he said or did. Her attitude amounted to this. "You know," she would say to her acquaintances, "Ivan Ilyich, like most people, simply cannot adhere to the course of treatment prescribed for him. One day he takes his drops, sticks to his diet, and goes to bed on time. But if I don't keep an eye on him, the next day he'll forget to take his medicine, eat sturgeon, which is forbidden, and sit up until 1 o'clock in the morning playing cards." "Oh, when was that?" Ivan Ilyich reported peevishly. "Only once at Pyotr Ivanovich's. And last night was Shebek. What difference did it make? I couldn't sleep anyway because of the pain." "Well, it really doesn't matter why you did it, but if you go on like this, you'll never get well and just keep on torturing us." From the remarks she made to both him and others, Praskovya Fyodorovna's attitude toward her husband's illness was that he himself was to blame for it, and that the whole thing was simply another way of making her life unpleasant. Ivan Ilyich felt that these remarks escaped her involuntarily, but this did not make things any easier for him. In court, too, Ivan Ilyich noticed, or thought he noticed, a strange attitude toward himself. At times he felt people were eyeing him closely as a man whose post would soon be vacant. At other times, his friends suddenly began teasing him in a friendly way about his nervous fears, as though that horrid, appalling, unheard of something that had been set in motion within him and was gnawing away at him night and day, ineluctably dragging him off somewhere, was a most agreeable subject for a joke. He was particularly irritated by Schwartz, whose playfulness, vivacity, and comme il faut manner reminded him of himself 10 years earlier. Friends came over to make up a set and sat down to a game of cards with him. They dealt, bending the new cards to soften them. Ivan Ilyich sorted the diamonds in his hand, and he found he had 7. His partner said, "No trumps," and supported him with 2 diamonds. What more could he have wished for? He ought to have felt cheered, invigorated. They would make a grand slam. But suddenly Ivan Ilyich became aware of that gnawing pain in his side, that taste in his mouth, and under the circumstances, it seemed preposterous to him to rejoice in a grand slam. He saw his partner, Mikhail Mikhailovich, rapping the table with a vigorous hand, courteously and indulgently refraining from snatching up the tricks, pushing them over to him so that he could have the pleasure of picking them up without having to exert himself. "Does he think I'm so weak I can't stretch my hand out?" Ivan Ilyich thought, and forgetting what he was doing, he over-trumped his partner, missing the grand slam by 3 tricks. And worst of all, he saw how upset Mikhail Mikhailovich was while he himself did not care, and it was dreadful to think why he did not care. They could see that he was in pain and said, "We can stop if you're tired. Rest for a while." Rest? Why, he wasn't the least bit tired. They'd finished the rubber. They were all gloomy and silent. Ivan Ilyich knew he was responsible for the gloom that had descended, but could do nothing to dispel it. After supper with friends, he went home, leaving Ivan Ilyich alone and the knowledge that his life had been poisoned and was poisoning the lives of others, and that far from diminishing, that poison was penetrating deeper and deeper into his entire being. And with this knowledge and the physical pain and the horror as well, he had to go to bed, often to be kept awake by pain the greater part of the night. And next morning, he had to get up again, dress, go to court, talk and write, or if he did not go, put in those 24 hours at home, every one of them a torture. And he had to go on living like this, on the brink of disaster, without a single person to understand and pity him. Chapter 5. 1 month went by this way, then another. Just before the new year, his brother-in-law came to town and stayed with him. Ivan Ilyich was at court when he arrived. Praskovya Fyodorovna was out shopping. On his return home, Ivan Ilyich found his brother-in-law, a robust, ebullient fellow, in the study unpacking his suitcase. The latter raised his head on hearing Ivan Ilyich's step and looked at him for a moment in silence. That look told Ivan Ilyich everything. His brother-in-law opened his mouth to gasp, but checked himself. That movement confirmed it all. "What is it? Have I changed?" Yes, you have. After that, try as he might to steer the conversation back to his appearance, Ivan Ilyich could not get a word out of his brother-in-law. When Praskovya Fyodorovna came back, her brother went in to see her. Ivan Ilyich locked the door of his room and began to examine himself in the mirror. First full face, then in profile. He picked up a photograph he had taken with his wife and compared it to what he saw in the mirror. The change was enormous. Then he bared his arms to the elbow, examined them, pulled down his sleeves, sat down on an ottoman, and fell into a mood blacker than night. I mustn't, he said to himself. He jumped up, went to his desk, opened a case file, started to read, but could not go on. He unlocked his door and went into the hall. The door to the drawing room was shut. He tiptoed over and began listening. "No, you're exaggerating," said Praskovya Fyodorovna. "Exaggerating? Can't you see for yourself? He's a dead man. Just look at his eyes. Not a spark of life in them. What's wrong with him?" "No one knows, Nikolaev. Another doctor said something, but I don't understand. Lechetitsky, the celebrated doctor, said just the opposite." Ivan Ilyich walked away, went to his room, lay down, and began thinking. A kidney, a floating kidney. He remembered everything the doctors had told him about how the kidney had come loose and was floating about, and by force of imagination he tried to catch that kidney and stop it, to hold it in place. It took so little effort, it seemed. "I'll go and see Pyotr Ivanovich again, the friend with the doctor friend." He rang, ordered the carriage, and got ready to leave. "Where are you going, Jean?" his wife asked in a particularly sad and unusually kind tone of voice. This unusual kindness on her part infuriated him. He gave her a somber look. "I've got to go and see Pyotr Ivanovich." He went to his friend with the doctor friend, and together they went to the doctor. They found him in, and Ivan Ilyich had a long talk with him. As he went over the anatomical and physiological details of what, in the doctor's view, was going on in him, Ivan Ilyich understood everything. There was just one thing, a tiny little thing in the cecum. It could be remedied entirely to stimulate the energy of one organ, depress the activity of another, then absorption would take place, and everything would be fine. You've been listening to Count Leo Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Ilyich. This is Mike Ailman. Thanks for listening, and good night from the bookshelf.